So first of all, let me thank Jay again for all of these invitations to speak before my favorite group of people, that is you. I'm not pandering either, because in my early days as a high school student, I was inspired by one of you. His name was Dominic Casulli. I went to school at Dumont High School. And if it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't have gone into biology. I would have been a carpenter. Maybe making a decent living now. But instead, I was inspired. And this individual encouraged me to get involved with a program at that point, which was run by Rutgers University. And it was sort of a talent search in high school for gifted students. And I never considered myself, or still don't consider myself, a gifted anything, except that I do listen. That's the one quality that I think makes someone look like a good student that probably isn't. As long as they listen, it's the main thing. You think they're nodding yes, and they're just nodding, I wonder when this will be over, sometimes. But for the most part, I listened. And so he allowed me to take an exam at Rutgers, which was open to all of the high school students identified by their biology teachers and chemistry teachers and physics teachers. And it was a science kind of a, you know, one of those general knowledge things that was a sort of a pre-SAT score thing. And I can't tell you how low I scored on that. I mean, I was almost at the bottom. And I was actually mortified. I said, I want to be a biologist, but I don't know anything. And so that actually started me on my sort of quest for bringing myself up to speed. And I've been doing that ever since. So I live a fortunate life, and you do too, because you get to see so many bright eyes and so many, you get to watch the light bulbs go on. And I have taught here for 38 years, so I'm not an emeritus professor, and I've seen those light bulbs get brighter, but they're already on when they come here. So I've taught to the medical students, to the school public health students, but my favorite group to teach to besides you is the third grade. I truly love the third grade, and I'll tell you why, because the third graders believe everything you tell them, everything. So you have to be sure that what you're telling them is true. And there's a huge responsibility at that grade level, because if you don't tell them the truth and later on they find out that you've been sort of telling them half-truths, they'll lose interest in that, not only that subject, but they will also talk about you. And eventually they'll run a blog and your name will be all over the internet, and it's just horrible stuff, horrible stuff. At any rate, so what you're about to hear is the progress, remarkable progress, of the germ of an idea that arose in one of my classes as the result of responding to the class's complete depression over having spent a half a semester working on a project that had no value whatsoever in their eyes. But the fact is it had huge value in their eyes. But they didn't know it, so I had to be there to tell them. That's what your job is. You have to tell people when they've become lucky. Right? Louis Pasteur, I don't know if you know this quote, but it's a great quote to keep. Louis Pasteur said, luck favors the prepared mind. That's a great quote, isn't it? If you read another book, however, that's one book. You can read his life story and you can get that quote from that book. Another book, though, is called From Archimedes to Hawking. Now, what is that book about? It's a book written about the laws of nature, and I highly recommend that book to you. It's the life history of each of these wonderful people, like Isaac Newton and Bernoulli and Einstein and Stephen Hawking. Now, I know something about Stephen Hawking because his father did the same thing I do. He was a parasitologist at Cambridge and, in fact, ran the National Laboratory for Parasite Research at Mill Hill for many years. And Stephen Hawking, of course, has gone on to other fame. So in that book, it says there's no such thing as luck. That's the bottom line on that. So you have to say to yourself, is there such thing as luck, or is there no such thing as luck? And what we perceive as luck is just something that we've made up to account for something we can't explain. And you have to tell your students that too, I think. That's a good thing to tell them, because if you have to know when you've been lucky, you know, when you dodge a bullet, so to speak, quite literally in some cases, or you get dumped out of a boat and you swim to shore and nobody gets hurt, which has happened to me. I just lost some equipment. But they now refer to that place where I dumped out of the boat as the Winston Rod Falls, because I lost a Winston Rod at the process. Thank God, it was only a Winston Rod, right? So does luck play a role in life or not? And if it doesn't, then what we're looking at here is deterministic behavior. Well, I'm drifting. Really, I want to stick to this subject. And so this subject happened by luck, in my view, in a class in 1999. And it happened after I had lost my grant, or actually I knew where it went. I didn't lose it. I just went to somebody else. that's not what you really look forward to in your life, especially when you've had one for 27 consecutive years, the same grant. Right. Right. And if you look yourself up at the NIH directory, it says you're among 0.01% of the grantees. And so you start to think of yourself as permanent. They're sure they'll give me my grant again. And the whole thing had changed underneath all of this to a different direction. And I wasn't doing genomics, and so therefore I wasn't involved in the switch. And therefore, when the new study section met and reviewed the grant, they gave it a great score but said, you know, it's not as relevant as, and then they just filled in that blank. And so I was now stuck with something to do. And so what could I do? I could get a job as a high school science teacher. Or maybe I could just give another course or two. So that's what I did. I gave another course or two. And one of them was Ecology 101, which I love. And the other course was called Medical Ecology. And in that course, this idea arose. Because halfway through it, the students started to complain bitterly about not being able to sleep. We can't eat. We can't drink. We don't know. We don't even want to breathe in anymore because the atmosphere is polluted. The foods are tainted. The water is impure. We don't even think we have a future. We're just going to go out and max out our credit cards and have a good time at the beach and forget about it. And I said, no, come on. There's a bright future for all of you here. Come on, look at how much money you're paying for this course, for instance. You're going to get something out of it at the end. And it all doesn't go into my pocket either. So, in fact, none of it went into my pocket. So the point is that they then reorganized the course. They had me stop talking about all these negative things that are going on, like Al Gore. How would you like to take a course with Al Gore? And Al Gore is standing there saying, and then the ice caps are melting, and the sea levels are rising, and sea surface temperatures are increasing. Therefore, the hurricane seasons will be longer. The agronomies will be terribly damaged, because for every degree of change upwards, you lose 10% of your land for farming. And he's not wrong. It's just that he doesn't have any solutions. Right? Isn't that the problem with seeing something like that, like Food Inc. or any of those other films that have these negative twists to them, that the sky is falling? Okay. Who made it fall? We did. So if we make it fall, we can make it rise. Ha! That's the positive aspect that you have to teach. You have to say, whatever's wrong, we can right, because we know what's wrong. If your car is not working well and the transmission doesn't work, we know how to fix it. But you have to know it's the transmission and not the brakes. So knowledge about the car is everything. Knowledge about the ecological setting that we live in is everything. So that began my quest for, I didn't know where I was going. I didn't have a clue as to where that was heading. They came up with rooftop gardening as their mantra. They said, we want to do something globally significant, but locally relevant. Now, that has a ring, too. You know, think globally, act locally. I knew the guy who made up that saying. His name was René Dubose. He worked at Rockefeller University, and I spent 3 golden years of my life at that place. And I became his friend, along with about 1,000 other people. He had a close following. We used to meet in places not dissimilar to this one, although there was a bar over there that had some interesting beers on tap. And we would sit and discuss, I don't know, what do you want to talk about? Gee, let's talk about the environment. What role does the environment play in health? Now, in those days, that was in 1967, 68, who the heck knew what role the environment played in health? Who knew? And the answer is, well, some people knew. Whoever established the EPA knew. That was not Richard Nixon, but it was done under Richard Nixon. It was done behind Richard Nixon's back, which is why when it was actually brought forth, he said 28 laboratories to test the water, the air, and the food. No, I don't think so. I can't do a good Richard Nixon, but my younger son can. He says, we'll only give you two of them. Just two. So that's what he did. He actually cut off 26 of the 28 regional laboratories that could have been analyzing your food and water and air right now. And instead, they are overwhelmed with requests, and so they can't do any of that. So they have to do spot checks. That's not good enough, right? Okay, so here we go. Let's talk about life in general. Now, I just push one of these buttons and it goes, or?
The enter button.
Just a moment, please. Thank you. Would you like to do that for me? Oh, I would love this. She's a facilitator. Oh, good. If I just go like that, would you then? Ow, I love it. All right, so here's a fast-forward history of the human species. I mean, really fast-forward, right? We began as a hot, molten ball of stuff 4.9 billion years ago. And as soon as it cooled, or before, life arose on this planet. That's an amazing fact, isn't it? I mean, how do you account for that? How do you account for it? I don't. It came from outer space. It arose as the result of chemical reactions in a primordial ooze. Who cares, right? It's here. And we are we're the most modern expression of complexity of life on Earth. So imagine us now as life on Earth studying life on Earth. Life on Earth evolved to the point where it could study itself. And here we are studying ourselves. We're looking in the mirror. So we arose out of the biosphere. Where there are cycles. You know this. There's the carbon cycle and the oxygen cycle and nitrogen cycle, the bicycle, the tricycle, the tricarboxylic acid cycle. I even remember that from my days in the lab. Some of you are working on that, I'm sure. There's no beginnings and ends on a cycle. You just pick a point and start, and then you can find yourself back at the beginning again, right? So that's how we began. That's how our lives evolved. We then arose out of the East African plains and emerged into the light of day. We're chased out of Africa by hyenas, no kidding, which arose in Europe, by the way. Hyena is not an African animal by birth. It's a European animal that found its way into Africa when the land bridges were revealed during an ice age. And we were chased off the bones of animals by hyenas, believe it or not, because that's what we used to eat mostly, because there was nothing else there to scavenge the bones, so we did that. And that's what gave us our meat, because the rest of the animal world was busy eating the rest. And then all of a sudden, the hyenas showed up and started to eat the bones also. Well, that's not a good thing. So we eventually escaped from the hyena paradigm and left that part of the world. And over the next 150,000 years, we, A, mated and hybridized with Neanderthals a little bit. Now, none of the people in this audience that have ancestors in Africa have any Neanderthal genomes in them whatsoever. None. Because the Neanderthal genomes never migrated backwards. They only migrated forwards. And that's about a month old. Did you know this or not? Am I telling you something new for the first time? All right. So the Western European and then Asian and then North American populations of humans contain remnants of Neanderthal genome. Now, if I had known that when I applied for my grant in 1999, I might have got it. I didn't. But none of those genes ever migrated back into Africa. So in Africa, you can actually trace your origins right back to a spot, whereas the rest of us are sort of nebulous as to where our origins originated after we left Africa. But one thing is quite certain. We extincted Neanderthals. Yeah. You know, we were good at something. How did we do it? And the answer is we did it with our... They were stronger than us. They were not as fast, but they were steadfast. And, of course, they guarded their caves with their lives for the unfriendlies. The friendlies they mated with, of course. What else was there to do? The point of that is that we think we killed them with our diseases. So we brought our diseases out of Africa, which weren't diseases to us. They were just infections. And we shared them with the rest of the world. Well, there was only one more hominid alive at that point. If you don't look at Floriansis down in Indonesia. And so we exposed them to our microbes. And what happened? Of course, they all died from them. Just like the Spanish killed off most of Mesoamerica when they came to this hemisphere with new organisms that people here had never seen before. So this happens all the time in nature. So it rearranges the landscape, and it's always going on, and so that's the part of evolution that everybody sort of gets, because what's the newest disease in the United States? West Nile virus. That's the newest entity that we have to deal with. How come you didn't even know that? You know why? Because you're used to it now. You've accepted it. It's here. It's not going to go away. Birds die. Sometimes people die, but mostly we just get sick. Ho-hum, yet another virus disease to deal with, right? That's transmitted by mosquitoes, by the way. Okay, so things always change. Over the next 145,000 years or so, make it 140,000 years, there wasn't a single farm on the planet. We were still hunters and gatherers, just like Neanderthals. We were busy chasing game, finding refuges away from danger, which equaled semi-desert areas where nobody else wanted to live because they didn't have a brain enough to figure out how to live there. But we did. We had a great brain. That's the one thing we had. Why? Because we were meat eaters as well as omnivores. And meat eating makes your brain grow faster. It's true. It's absolutely true. The moment we begin eating meat, you can tell by the dentition and the marks on the bones, etc. The moment we did that, our evolution went fast-forwarded. Our brain size increased. Now, bigger brains doesn't mean you can think better, but it, in most cases, it does. So here we were at places that were challenged environmentally for water, for food, for housing, but not for warding off the evil spirits of predators like lions and tigers and bears. So we settled there. But we had to settle there in a special way. And that way was we couldn't hunt and gather anymore because it was too risky. That's one hypothesis. There are many others. But remember Louis Pasteur's original saying, luck favors the prepared mind. So how do you get lucky about inventing farming, which was what happened 11,000 or so years ago around the world in 10 different places, unable to communicate unless you believe in aliens, that brought farming to this planet? Forget that. It's not a viable hypothesis. So all of these challenged environmental places had lots of people living there. So they would go to their water supply, which was way over there someplace because the animals went there too, and we didn't want to live where they lived, haha, because they knew about us. We would go collect water every now and then, collect grains that grew around these little places called oases, or irrigation ditches that we invented, like in the American Southwest, or the Incas, or the Aztecs, or you've been to some of those places, some of you, like Machu Picchu. That's a great place, right? And all of a sudden, the grains that we harvested were dropping on the ground, and the water we harvested was dropping on the ground, and the next thing you knew, there was a trail of plants leading back to where you lived. Wait a minute. I think we're onto something here. You don't have to go all the way over there. If you bring enough water back over here, and you take these seeds, they didn't call them seeds, they called it food, because they were eating it, and you just throw it on the ground, I can't believe this, but grows. It absolutely grows, and that's incredible. Neanderthals never farmed. They gathered, and the enrichment of their environment with these grains allowed them to live there, but they never understood the process. But we did. So 11,000 years ago, we invented farming, 11,000 years ago. And now, from that point to now, right? Look what happened. From 11,000 years ago to now, I'm jumping ahead. We invented the technosphere. That's what we did. Food, reliable, sustainable, living in one place. Not everybody has to farm. Not everybody has to hunt and gather or process the food. You can eat and do something else. You can learn how to write. You better invent that first. We can invent civilization. And this is a very fast-forward story that's missing a lot of parts. But just know that the calendar, mathematics, religion, astronomy, all of those arose out of a need to predict the next growing seasons or to account for failures of growing seasons by weather events. Imagine how many religious rituals are gathered around the concept of, hooray, our crops are in, or, oh, our crops failed. Look at the anthropological setting and all of the language that's associated with it. And why would we ever have to write anything down if we were hunter-gatherers? But we would have to write something down if you wanted to pass the information on how to grow that food to the next generation. So there's a lot of lists of things to do that we invented from 11,000 years ago to today, which relate to producing food safely and securely, which will allow, of course, us to live in a better world. Our population at the moment of farming invention was about 1 million. Today, 6.8 billion. Wow. That's incredible. You know, that's like taking a culture dish and having the media in the culture dish, and then you put one bacterium on it, close the lid, put it in the incubator, and wait. How long do you have to wait before the whole plate fills up? Well, it's a 20-minute life cycle for E. coli, so 20 minutes times 2, times 4, times 8, times 16, you get the picture. In spades, you get the picture, because it's really quick at some point. It's there, and then it's not there, and then it's there. All of a sudden, you've got a plate full of something. Well, this is the plate, and we are the something. And we're now, are we to bursting or not? Ah. Way ahead of the story. Yeah, so the technosphere has these crazy things associated with them. Try it again. Yeah, this is the problem. There's no other problem than this. That's the only problem. If we had created a circle technosphere, it doesn't matter how many people you put on the planet, as long as everybody has enough, and you don't hurt anything else. Hurting anything else hurts you. That's the concept that I got more and more from my teaching of the course in ecology that I began in 1999. The more you hurt them, the more they hurt you. Because you are them, and they are you. There's no difference, just your shapes. Your biological needs are the same, absolutely the same. You try to tell that to somebody who's a racist or a creationist, or somebody who doesn't want to think about this. And they'll just accuse you of being a communist, probably. I'm a one-species kind of guy. I believe in the DNA molecule. And you don't. That's too bad, because your life will suffer as the result. I wish I could take away all of the trappings from those people that related to the technological advances that we have benefited from. There goes the TV, there goes the car, there goes the house, there goes your clothes, there goes virtually everything is based on the ability to manipulate our environment to our own benefit, right? And yet people reject that as a they hate science. They hate it. Why? Because it forces them to say, I don't know. And if you can say, I know, then, well, the Bible says that. See, now, I don't disbelieve in the Bible, don't get me wrong. But I have a take on this that goes back a little bit further than that. In fact, in this book, From Archimedes to Hawking, you'll find that almost every scientist that invented or came up with a law of nature was a theist and believed what they were really discovering were the laws of God set down when all of this was first created, and now it follows those laws. So if you want to convince people that they should pay attention to science, you can use that as a reasoning point to say you don't have to disbelieve in God just because you believe in science. Science is merely the explanation of natural laws, and natural laws were created by God, if you wish. And that gets you out of a loop. Maybe. Not with their parents, but certainly with the kids. All right. Let's see what happens next. So this is what I believe. And I hope you do too, because how could you not believe in this? So next, please. I'll just say next. Thank you. So these are our big challenges facing the world today because of so many people, right? Next. Oh, this will all be online, right, Jay? Or it'll be on the DVD?
It'll be on the DVD, and the audio will be online.
Superb. So this is where we are today. 6.8 billion people now need to farm a landmass the size of South America.
What?
The size of South America? Are you kidding? Have you ever been to South America? You should say that to your kids. Yeah, I've been to South America. It's big. I mean, it's real big. How big is it? It's so big that just Brazil alone is bigger than the United States minus Alaska. That's big. I didn't know that. Yeah, it's bigger. It's bigger. Oh, really? Okay, so now let's see what happens. Next. When we add some more people. Next. Let's assume that everything is fine right now. It's okay. Everything is okay. But it's not going to be okay if we've reached the max of production and there's still going to be more people. Well, more people, don't get me wrong here either. I'm not a Malthusian. I'm not against more people. I'm against more people living a crummy life. That's what I'm against. Well, we live better than normal lives. And that's a bit of a socialist attitude, you know, but it's not. It's really a species attitude. Because if you're an ant, or a termite, or a wasp, or some other social insect, the entire hive, the entire nest, the entire mound receives similar resources for staying alive. And then you can do something else afterwards. You're either a worker bee or you're not a worker bee. You're a gatherer ant, or you're a harvester ant, or you're the queen. But everybody gets the same amount of food. Everybody gets the same amount of water because you're an ant. What's wrong with that? Nothing. So why do we sell that stuff? Why is it sold? Why is there a value to it? It should be valued so high that everybody gets some, enough. Put it like that. Put it like that. It's a biological thing. It's not an economic thing. It's not a social thing. It's a biological thing. Food, water, biological thing. Clean air, biological thing. Science. Where did we go wrong? I know, as soon as money or bartering was invented, and I have more than you and you want some, you have to do something for me to get it. I'm not against that in principle, but, you know, it's the world I was raised in. Let's see what happens when we get another 3 billion people, though. Next. If this is how much 6.8 billion people need, watch how much more 3 billion more people need. Now, that article in 2001, that's the one I should have sent you. I would like you all to look that article up and somehow paraphrase it for your class, because that article has continued to keep me up at night. I'm not joking. I'm not just saying that because I want you to feel my pain. It's an intellectual pain. These people were hired by Science Magazine to write the article. That never happens. You ask anybody in science whether they ever read an article published in Science Magazine, and if they said yes, they were among the lucky few. And now luck does play a role in whether your article actually gets published in science or not. It has to be relevant to a large community of scientists, although reading the article, you wouldn't guess that. But the point is that it's difficult to get your articles published in Science. And Science magazine came to these people and said, please write us an article about the future of agriculture as you see it. And what they said was this. They said, agriculture has the possibility of trashing the entire planet if we continue to do it the way we're doing it. That's in 2001. I remember I started to teach this other course in 1999. Next, please. Pardon. So if this is how much land there is, next. And this is how much we already use, next. And there's not enough left. Okay, so let's talk about agriculture then, because that's the crux of the matter here. Agriculture, next, please. Today, modern agriculture requires all of this to succeed. Why? Because it's not an ecological thing to do, no matter which way you slice it. Farming, I was going to say farming sucks, but you can't say that in class. Maybe you can. If you do, they'll understand it better. Farming sucks. Here's why. It sucks the earth of its resources. It sucks the water up out of the ground. It sucks away your health by giving you produce that's tainted with herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers. It gives you no water back for your money. In fact, it takes 70% of the Earth's liquid fresh water minus Lake Baikal. You have to say minus Lake Baikal. Why? Because 20% of the world's liquid water is in Lake Baikal. That's an incredible amount of liquid fresh water, isn't it? 20% of the liquid fresh water is in one single stinking little place, and it's in Siberia, of all things. So it's unavailable. The rest of the world deals with what's left. And 70% of what's left is used for farming. Who farms? Do you farm? Does anybody here farm? Raise your hands if you farm. No hands went up. That's right. Nobody farms because you live in a city, right? Wow, I'll change that attitude. He gardens. Okay, gardening is farming. I include that. Do you use Miracle-Gro in your crops? You do not. Do you compost? You do not. You should compost. You what? We'll get to this. Okay, but you know, you can't criticize agriculture for what it did. It actually allowed the human population to rise from 1 million to now 6.8 billion people. That's a lot of genomes. That's a lot of computers. That's a lot of thinking. That's a lot of problem solving. That's a lot of, wow, look how bright our future could be, thinking. We're all connected now, aren't we? Sure. Just like an ant mound. They connect with formic acid, by the way. That's not such a great way to communicate, is it? You want to have some fun ones? Get a hold of a dilute solution of formic acid. Go out to the sidewalk and find some swarming ants and spell your name out in script. And you will get the ants to actually do that for you. Or you could spell other words, too, if you're so oriented towards that. That's true, by the way, because that's how they find their way back to the nest. They leave a little trail of formic acid. All right? It's cool, right? Cool stuff. Okay. It's like watching the Ohio State band spell out Ohio during halftime. Okay, let's see what happened with farming then. Oh, yeah, we get our food, but... And we get tainted food, by the way, tainted food. And the trouble with tainted food is that it ain't enough. No, that's not true. That was the saying that our dean here made once, Dean Merritt, about tainted money. The trouble with tainted money is that it ain't enough. Right. Agricultural runoff. We don't think about agricultural runoff. You know why? Because nobody here farms. You don't farm. You just garden. So if you farmed, you'd know what this is. Agricultural runoff is what happens after you've used 70% of the available fresh water for farming and you've tainted it with, or you've had to taint it with, herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers to shift the ecological balance away from a diverse situation to a monocrop, which is protected against invasion by plant diseases and insect pests. That's what that's all about. It's to upset the ecological balance in favor of us. That's all it is. By the way, medicine, if you wanted to define medicine in another way, medicine is trying to hold back evolutionary process. by taking natural selection away from the equation and making artificial selection, which we invent, the driver in terms of evolution. I'm not against that, obviously, because I spent 38 years of my life at a medical center preaching the gospel in various ways to students. So I'm a parasitologist by training. So someone here actually said that they heard me once on Radiolab. I was on Radiolab. I love that show. And I don't know if you do, but I love it. And so I had to tell them my take on hookworm disease and how that came. You heard that too? Yeah, because it has a twist there, doesn't it? We'll talk about that another time. Maybe next year. if Jay doesn't lose his grant. You see, so that's another story. So let's see the next slide then. Agricultural runoff does this. It creates dead zones. In addition to, of course, offshore drilling, the dead zones by far outweigh the damage being done now by BP. By far! You wouldn't believe BP's damage to the environment is a minuscule drop in the bucket compared to the damage done by agricultural runoff around the world. And the reason is because a lot of that water is not absorbed by the plants, and they go into an irrigation ditch that then collects all that water after they irrigate, and it collects it and puts it back into the source that they took it from to begin with. If it's an irrigation canal, no, you can't do that because the other farmers have to use that water. They're very strict about their own water, but they're not strict at all about everybody else's water. So that water can go back into the river. It can go back into the lake. It can go back into the ocean. And the reason why we don't control it for the EPA, the Justice Department, the United States Department of Agriculture, is because we cannot control it. It can't be controlled. So you can't make legislation against something that no one can help. You can't do it. I mean, people have to pollute in order to grow food. And food is the basis for life on Earth. So therefore, we can't regulate it. That's pretty sad, though, because if we could, a lot of this could be prevented. Next slide. So here we are. I'm not sure that's the city of identifiable. Yeah, that's Jersey City, actually. This presentation was made for Jersey City originally, but it applies here, too. That's a big statistic. That's okay. Go ahead. You can go ahead. Try it again. Can we? Don't push it yet. Don't push it yet. Who can say no to this? We can talk. Of course we can do this. How? We'll just take Brazil, and we'll deforest it, and we'll grow food. That's what we can do, and we can feed another 3 billion people. It's a fact. I can show you an article that says that. I can show you many articles that say that. Now, Brazil might be a little bit depressed right now because they didn't even make it to the quarterfinals. That's sad. Oh, so sad. Kaká was not on everybody's lips. Although we all know what caca is, don't we? Don't step in it. So let's push the button and find out what else we have to do too, though. Because otherwise, if we do that, then we will all die. And we will die a painful, slow, agonizing extinction death associated with, well, maybe something that you might see in a movie like Soylent Green or something obtuse like that. We have damaged Earth's ecosystems almost to the breaking point. Not quite. Almost. It's still got resiliency. It still has biodiversity. It still has the ability to self-repair if we leave it alone. But it's going to be tough. Try telling someone not to touch wet paint. Right? Or mommy just made some cookies. Don't touch them. The moment you turn your back, you got kids, right? I've had two kids. I've got three grandchildren. I've got a great grandchild. And they don't know what the word no means until you demonstrate physically what that word actually means. So keeping your hands off is difficult at every level, including the environment. Who's in control of it anyway? Garrett Hardin, another essay to read. Garrett Hardin called Tragedy of the Commons, written in 1967. You know what? If he were here today, he would say, have to revise. Sorry, have to revise. Yeah, big time. because at that point, no population on Earth was in decline. Every one of them was increasing. And he said, if this continues, here's what's going to happen. There's only so much. And so if more people with the same amount, everybody gets less. Or actually, whoever gets there first gets most. Whoever gets there second gets next most. Third, next most. You know, LeBron James thinks that he's going to win a championship, doesn't he? You know what? One of those guys gets injured, all the bets are off. And everybody gets injured. So he's not accounting for that little equation. We have to do both of these things. We have to supply enough food for the next 3 billion people, and at the same time, we have to repair the environment. Or, you don't even have to draw pictures for this. You can just say or. Everybody in your class will understand the or. Everyone. Let's see what happens. So here's how to do it. It's a dumb, simple idea. The best ideas are all simple, straightforward. They've all been invented already, and all you have to do is put them together in another configuration, like a box of Lego, which is fun to play with. And I'm trying to convince the Lego Corporation to make a vertical farm iteration, which you'll see. And that would be great, because then the kids could play with it and imagine what one would be like, and eventually they will start demanding them because they know what they can do. Here's what we can already do. We already do this around the world in places where we have to do this. We use hydroponics, we use aeroponics, which is an even more conserving way of using water. And we use drip irrigation. Drip irrigation turns out not to be such a great idea. If you go to Israel and look at what they're doing, their water budgets are the same. How does that work? I'm just dripping it over here and I'm pouring it over here and it's the same? Yeah, because you're dripping it all day long, all night long, all day long, all night long. Yeah. Oh, I see. Now, what do you expect us to do then? I'll show you. Here's what's happening today. Rice in the basement of Japan's cities. Hydroponic tomatoes from the middle of the Arizona desert. 318 acres of hydroponic farming. 40,000 heads per day of lettuce from a Tennessee indoor hydroponic lettuce farm. What? Are you kidding? Now, these are not your four main food groups necessarily. Tomatoes and lettuce, you can make a nice salad, but it would be hard to feed people in Darfur or Niger or Mali or Haiti or anywhere else where food is really absent. Or in inner cities. Next. So if we grow our food indoors, but in tall buildings, we can then lower the agricultural footprint, we can bring the food to the people, and we can democratize food and eliminate the economic burden of food production somewhat. Not altogether, but somewhat. Here's what you can grow indoors to confluence. When I mean confluence, when you have a petri dish and you put a single organism on it and you sit back and wait, it'll grow to confluence. When you take these crops as seeds and use rock wool to start them and then transplant them into a hydroponic setting, as long as you give them enough to eat, they're happy. So how do you give them enough to eat? Well, you have to know what they eat. They eat 16 elements. Plants eat 16 elements. That's it. How many elements are there? Yes. That's a lot of elements. They only need 16 of these things. Come on, this is so easy. It's so easy to do it. I mean, we did it so easy. We invented this in the 1930s. It was applied to the Second World War situation and then abandoned after the war was over because there was all this new land because all the farmers had gone to war. Remember seeing Saving Private Ryan? That was a whole movie about farming. No, it was about the Second World War. No. It was about farming. Because four Ryans got killed? No, only three. We needed someone to work that farm. See how valuable farming is? Even then, they sent a whole platoon out to look for Ryan. to make sure that they had one person to put back on that farm, to make sure that the American agricultural setting didn't disappear because you had to feed the troops. That's how important food is. Here's what you can grow. Yeah, that's right. So you just put all of it together from that Lego box that I've just given you, and you get what comes next. Right. If you take a single-story building, that high-tech hydroponics, and you stack them on top of each other, now, you're going to probably call this a sexist remark, but I'm going to give it to you anyway because it's got some humor associated with it. I call it Viagra culture. Because you're going to grow it up and up. And it's, you can grow it as high as you want. That's where it differs from Viagra. Next, please. And we won't take that analogy any further. So if we could do it, if we could do it. What do you mean, if we could do it? I thought you said we could do it. Oh, yeah, we can do this. Let's see what happens. We don't get any agricultural runoff. We get to save all of that water. Why? Because hydroponic farming uses 70% less water than agriculture uses. And aeroponics uses 70% less than hydroponics. So what is aeroponics? It just sprays a mist of nutrient-laden water onto the root systems of plants. Now, the difficulty there is that managing the valves that makes the spray. But there are some new solutions to that that have overcome that difficulty. They don't clog up anymore. It's cool stuff. You put a plastic bag over the bottom of a plant, and you have a mister, that you know, just an atomizer, and in the vessel, you've made your nutrient solution like with Miracle-Gro, only this time it's chemically defined Miracle-Gro. And you just spray it every now and then inside. The root systems stay moist. Keep the temperature low, maybe 20 degrees centigrade. The next thing you know, you've got corn, wheat, rice, barley, potatoes, you name it. You name it. Next slide. We get continuous production of crops. What's wrong with that? No seasons. It's all indoors. You can control it. You think it's too cool in here? You think it's too warm in here? Turn up the air conditioner. Turn down the air conditioner. What do you want? These buildings will be designed for plants that people work in. So you have to find out what the plants want. We already know that. So you know there's an agricultural school per state? There's one ag school per state. There's one IT school per state. It was invented back in the 1800s. Why? Because even then they realized that agriculture is a specialized, science-based food production system. So every state has the ability to take this idea and manipulate it to their own desires. Unless we get a tornado that comes down and wipes out the farm in terms of the building, you won't get any crops lost because of severe weather damage. Outdoor crops, we lose 50% of what we plant every year in this country from something. Drought, flood, insect pests, viruses, fungal diseases of root systems, root knot nematodes, you name it, and there are diseases out there waiting for these things because that's what nature is all about. It's about parasitism. That's what attracted me to that subject. Next, please. Less water. No agrochemicals, none, no pesticides, no herbicides. Why? Because we've eliminated the competition by sealing them off from this physical barrier. And most importantly, what if we could take just some of the farmland and return it to nature? Would you like to read a beautiful book? And if you do, would you like to read this book to your class? And the answer is, of course. Who would say no to that? It's called The Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold was a friend of John Muir and a friend of Theodore Roosevelt's, and he was instrumental in establishing Yellowstone National Park as the first national park in the world, which I just returned from. And I can tell you it's as beautiful now as it ever was when I was there. So his book, A Sand County Almanac, documents what happened to his father's farm when his father decided not to farm anymore. Why? Because it was economically unviable. Why? Because it was in the middle of the Wisconsin woods. It's not a farm setting. So he abandoned the farm. So Aldo sat there year after year and watched nature return. And it's beautiful to watch nature return because it never went away. It just sort of was in hiding, even in the city of New York. I'll ask you this question, since you all are from the New York City area. Is this correct, except for our two visitors? How many different species of mosquitoes do you think live in the confines of the city of New York? I'll give you some choices. 10 different species. Raise your hands. 20 different species. 30 different species. You can't tell by the inflection of my voice which is the correct answer, by the way. I'm not going to give this away. 40 different species. 50 different species. 60 different species. Oh, okay, it's 60. It's actually 63 different species of mosquitoes live within the confines of New York City. And guess which one transmits West Nile virus 99.9% of the time? Culex pipiens. One species. And they all have different biologies. So if you don't know that and you think, oh, we'll just get rid of the mosquitoes. Think again. You have to get rid of 63 different biologies in order to get rid of 63 different mosquitoes. Culex pipiens, you know where it breeds? At the 14 waste treatment plants. And then next best breeding site? Woodlawn Cemetery in the little flower pots. Imagine going to pay homage to your dead ones that just died from West Nile virus and having the mosquitoes that gave it to them give it to you as you're sitting there. Well, you know, you gather that I'm not a big fan of religion. Next, please. We also remediate gray water with plants that you don't even have to eat. Plants will do this free of charge if you let them do this. So you can percolate gray water, which is the sludge part of black water removed, through plants, and their root systems and leaves will actually transpire the water and make it pure for you. You can collect that water. If we had a dehumidifier in this room right now, you'd have drinking water for everybody in about 20 minutes. It's an amazing process, right? You've had a cold drink in your hand, you sit it down on a table outdoors, and it starts to sweat, and you've got this pool of water at the bottom. Where the hell did that come from? It didn't seep through the glass. It came from the atmosphere. Sure. So if you use a heat exchanger in a room filled with plants that you don't eat and gray water, you will transpire the gray water into pure water, and you can now drink that, or you can use that in the vertical farm. New York City throws away 1 billion gallons of gray water every single day. Every single day, New York City throws away 1 billion or plus, and depends on if it had rain or not. Last night we had a thunderstorm. Sure, it exceeded the 1 billion gallons last night. And how much energy do you think we throw away in terms of sludge, which is traceable back to your fecal events? On an annual basis, we throw away 900 million kilowatt hours of electricity that we could have generated by burning it in a high-tech incinerator. That's enough to fuel 100 vertical farms. We're going to create new jobs. Your kids want to know, why am I studying anyway? Why do I have to stay in high school? Why can't I just go out and get a job? Because there aren't any. Stay in school. Do not leave. Even if they want you to, don't go. Stay. Am I running out of time?
No.
Good. Okay. Let's have another one. Well, what could be better than this? No one would disagree with this. And as a matter of fact, there's a huge movement in the urban environment for urban farming. Huge. It's huge. There are some exceptions, of course. That's okay. You've got the message now. Don't grow sunflowers. Grow, you know, green beans or potatoes or cabbage or bell peppers or carrots. Make sure you test the soil first to make sure it doesn't contaminate, have any contaminations like lead or cadmium or vanadium. How do you get that tested? Take it to an EPA lab. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Nixon, I think you illuminated those. Yes. That's all right. New York State will do it for you. We get to use abandoned city properties like all the brownfields that you can possibly think of. Why? Because we're building above that. We don't care what happened below it. We're not taking advantage of what happened below it. We're going to build everything new above it. Let's see another one. And if you so desire, you can work on a carbon neutral situation and grow biofuels that you then burn. The CO2 is taken up by those plants again and recycled back into new plants. So that's why it's a carbon neutral situation. I don't want to burn anything. Let's talk about something else. For instance, passive energy capture. Sunlight, tidal power, geothermal, wind, those are all viable. That's okay. These two items, food and water, are precious commodities in everywhere. The only difference is that you can afford them, and most other people in many other places cannot. The chart that you'll see for the DVD, you can't read that. It just has Cambodia at the top, and the little line is the availability of fresh water, and the big line is the rate of infant mortality in that country. So the higher the rate of infant mortality, the lower their accessibility to fresh drinking water, which is a one-on-one correlation. Kids are dying from diarrheal diseases that they catch from drinking bad water. That's the conclusion. Well, if that's the case, let's just solve that problem. If you kids survive long enough, the birth rate of that country will go down, not up. How do I know that? Japan and Korea recently announced zero population. China will too. So will India. As soon as the economics dictates that you'd rather have a plasma screen television than another kid, you will have another television, not another kid. And that's the driving force here. So it is an economic concern at one point. Trick is, how do you make these poor countries wealthier so that they come up to the minimum standards of food and water so their kids can stay in school long enough to learn something that will give them a life rather than having to worry about where their next meal comes from? Education is everything. Literacy is everything. You know this because you're in the education business. And I know this too. But to tell that to these people, if the literacy rate goes up, you can make that same chart for literacy and you'll get the same graph with the same countries. That's ridiculous. Next. Lots of food riots and emergencies around the world. It varies with the weather. It varies with the politics. But it's still not going to go away. Even if we want it to go away, it's not going to go away. Next. So the vision of the future that I want to offer you is to think of yourself living in a definable ecosystem that you create yourself. You're going to create this ecosystem. Now, you can't create an ecosystem unless you understand what a regular ecosystem is, right? So that's why the ecology part of teaching is so important. Because if you can't teach somebody how Aldo Leopold's farm grew back and manages itself without anybody's help, then they don't understand how a city could behave the same way. Well, why can't it behave the same way? You're a biological specimen, just like a tree or a bee or an ant or a worm. You're the same. You want some proof? Yeah, well, look at your DNA. They all use the same coding. It's the same. It's just a different manifestation. So we can behave like an ecosystem if we want to do that. Do we want to do it? Some of us do, some of us don't. Who does? The people that need it. And who doesn't? The people that are charging you. The people that are controlling politics. The people that are controlling economics. The people that are controlling property development and all those other things that on the outset look pretty innocent. But when you start to say, well, we need to change, you're not going to get much response from those people. They're going to say things that you don't want to hear. So what will force those things to change? And the things that will force them to change will be economic drivers. Next slide. We already know how to do it. Next. And so this is what I propose. This is what we would end up with if we did it. We would end up processing all of our waste back into an agricultural setting using the water and the energy contained in our own feces to manage the energy system and the water system. And that's all doable. That's a balanced, sustainable system. The more vertical farms you have, the more people that eat from them, the more processing of water and energy back to the grid that you make, the more sustainable it becomes for more people. I've given this talk in many places. One of them that I had the thrill of going to was the Canary Islands. I was in Tenerife. One of the players yesterday was from Tenerife in Spain. They made a point of saying that because otherwise you would have said, Tenerife, that's an island off the coast of Africa. What are they doing playing for Spain? Did they once own them? They don't own them. It's part of Spain. It's part of the country of Spain. They wanted to know about this a lot because they're an island. They would rather not import everything. Wait a minute. We're an island. You know, there's a lot of islands out there. It depends on how you look at yourself. The whole earth is an island. Okay, so Just make the island bigger, that's all. Next. So, and everyone will say, ah, come on, you can't do this. I don't have to say that anymore. I said, yes, we can. Let's take a look. We're already doing it. Next slide. Here's how to make drinking water out of black water. They're doing it in Santa Ana, California, but there was a little bit of social marketing involved in this one because people didn't really want to drink the water coming out of that plant that cost $500 million to make because they could afford it, because they had to go on to Arnold in California, and Mr. Governor Schwarzenegger said, you want more water when everybody else is suffering? Find water some other place. So they thought about desalinization. That's too expensive. They said, well, wait a minute. We already make our own water. All we have to do is recapture it. So they did, but then they wouldn't drink it. Well, that's no good. If you just make it again and you won't drink it, what good is it then? But they said, oh, wait, I have a solution. We're going to take it up into the San Bernardino Mountains. We will dump it over the ground. We will let the ground fill up with the aquifer again. We'll go down below that, and we'll withdraw it from the ground with wells, and we'll say, no, your water doesn't come from over there. It comes from over here. And they bought it. They said, oh, in that case, sure. I'll be glad to drink it. They wouldn't say it like that, but they did say that we will drink water from the ground, but we will not drink water from a factory that makes it better than the ground filters it. They'll come around eventually. Next slide. And what about the processing of waste? Waste is our biggest problem, right? But it really is unrealized energy, basically. So if you grind up everything into a powder, which you can do easily, with little or no energy compared to the amount of energy it took to take the waste and dump it into the landfill, and then apply it to a new technology that's available now called plasma arc gasification. What this does is it returns everything back to their elements by pyrolysis. So that 100 and how many elements do we have? 119 elements. If they were all contained in this table, which they're not, and we ground up this table into a fine powder and we ran it through this device, which has an enormous hot arc of electricity that meets in the middle to form a plasma, which is equivalent to everything that you know about the sun. So the sun is a plasma held together by gravity, mostly composed of hydrogen, that makes helium as a result, right? This machine takes electricity and makes a plasma for you, and then you spray this powder through that plasma arc, and everything disintegrates back into the elements. And it gives off energy because the bonds that hold these things together are broken. The energy is released. Half of that energy goes to running this machine. Half, only half. The other half that you get back by making something called syngas, which is a combination of carbon monoxide and hydrogen to make CH3O, that can be burned cleanly. And the energy from that you can use. You get half. That's a very efficient engine. It's much more efficient than a combustion engine, for instance. So that means that fresh kills, it's essentially a coal mine that you could take all of that material, grind it up, run it through this device, and recapture all of the energy locked up in those non-rotting wastes that we have put into these horrible places that people have to live near. We can do it now. Japan runs its entire country this way. Next. So what would a vertical farm look like? Well, once I had to give a talk in Dubai, so I thought maybe a pyramid might be a nice shape. Four main food groups, you know, sort of a play on words. They didn't get it, by the way. They didn't get it. But they liked the idea of a pyramid, and making it out of clear, transparent material like ethylene tetrafluoroethylene, which is the composition of the windows for a project called the Eden Project, which I highly recommend you're going to and looking at. The Eden Project exists in the south of England, and it's huge, super dome-sized domes of clear material framed out in aluminum. And it's so clear, the material is so clear that you can do astronomy through it. So it's incredibly transparent, it's incredibly lightweight, and it's incredibly strong, and it self-cleans. Wow, all of that together in one substance. It's called Teflon. It's about like Teflon, but it's clear. You can build a whole building out of that if you'd like. They've done it already. So no new technology is needed. Next. Here's a really great submission. By the way, we have a website called verticalfarm.org, which obviously, I highly recommend you going to. And I have a book called The Vertical Farm coming out in October, which I highly recommend you're adopting as a schoolroom project. I'll be there to gladly sign those books for you. Cheap, too. No, that's pandering. I take that all back. The point is that we've got this website up now since 2001. And we've had numbers of submissions now, unsolicited, from around the world. And this one came to us from Israel. And it's a really practical approach to making a vertical farm work. They've got all the bells and whistles in it, and it would actually function if they could build it. Not if, when. Yeah. Look at how attractive this is. How would you like to work in that building? You know, farming really does suck, especially if you're a farmer. What do you call the kids of a successful farmer? Teachers, doctors, lawyers. You don't call them farmers, though, that's for sure. Because they know that you get 3 crops in 10 that you can sell, and the other 7 are total waste. That's why we have crop insurance. That's why the U.S. Farm Bill in 2003 was $281 billion, and half of that went for crop insurance. Half. Imagine. Half of $281 billion to pay farmers because they had bad luck. Ah, there is luck. Ah, the luck is that you live right here. When the weather changes, you can't move. Is the weather changing? You're damn right it's changing. Whether anyone believes that or not, that's opposed to the climate change panel or not, it's changing. And you just ask any farmer. They'll gladly tell you. Here's Toronto. This is just eye candy. I'll just go through these pretty fast. They don't require explanation. This one's going to make the cover of our book. It's a cleverly designed building. It almost got built in Chicago. Here's one for Australia. Who needs it? Australia, boy, do they. Here's one from Harvard School of Architecture that took Manhattan as the island of choice and built this iteration. You'll see this. This is really quite interesting. I mean, look at how detailed this thing is. I mean, if you gave this to a series of construction engineers and designers, they could build this. Yes?
I have a question.
Sure.
About, okay.
I'm not done yet, though. I'm not done yet. Could you hold your question for the end? Or? Okay. Because I'll stay here as long as you want afterwards. Santiago, Chile. If they had built this in Santiago, of course, it would have been on the ground because they had a big earthquake down there. But look at how detailed and how wonderful these things are. Expense. I hope your question is about how expensive these might be and who's going to use them to begin with. Yeah, that's right. Here's something we have at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. You might recognize that person in the background there. So this is where you start. You don't start with these big operations. You start with something like this. Next slide. Like that. That's a prototype. This is a third grade prototype. This is a kid's project. It's incredible. I don't know who the teacher was, but I love this one. That's my favorite of all the designs. That's my favorite. Because it gets them to think about all the parts and how it could work and what it could produce and who would be using it and how much it might cost and where you might want to locate it. All these questions, you could answer those questions based on the kids just working on this. So, but here's the one we are very proud of. This will be built. This will be built. Get that? Not should. Will be built in Newark, New Jersey. Not Newark, Delaware. Newark, New Jersey. And for whom are we building this? And the answer is for whoever needs it. This is a think tank incubator industry that invites in a restaurateur, a school district, a firehouse, an apartment complex, and says, you want to grow your own food? Here's how to do it. Here's the learning center for urban agriculture. It is a learning center. You need learning centers. You can't start with commercially viable buildings. There are some that think you can. You know what they're going to do? They're going to end up growing lettuce for the high-end restaurant industry. Farming sucks. So does economically driven models that don't take into account who needs this. Next. Look at how beautiful this is. And this was designed by a group in Seattle. At my recommendation, they came out to Newark and we gave them a presentation about 3 months ago. And now they're looking for money. $40 million to build it. And this is what it might look like if it gets built. I should say when it gets built. Next, please. These are all of my students who have worked on this from 1999 to the present. I don't have their names listed from 1999 to 2003, but they're in my mind. Next slide. And this was just last year's class. So, keep going. Right. Okay. Thank you.